On this information-packed episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we welcome our new sponsor, CareDirect, talk about the latest news in the ASC industry, discuss CMS regulatory changes with potentially major impacts on the industry, and review pharmacy security with our guest, Nader Sahar from CareDirect.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by CareDirect LLC. CareDirect manufactures medication security cabinets that improve efficiency and safety in healthcare facilities by electronically managing medications near patient care areas. CareDirect's medication workflow products are designed for hospitals, surgery centers, community health centers, clinics, emergency departments, veterinary facilities, and dental practices. Their cabinets are particularly well-suited for ambulatory surgery centers, and they are an affordable alternative to both traditional double-locked cabinets and the more expensive electronic alternatives that were designed for hospitals. For more information, please visit their website at CareDirectLLC.com. Welcome to episode 68 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for October 7th, 2019. We're recording from our studio in Spenceport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including The Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. Well, this is definitely going to be a full episode, a lot going on.
And definitely a whirlwind since I rushed home from a survey. One of our centers was surveyed yesterday, which is a Saturday, and I'm home for like 13 hours.
Yep.
So we're recording this episode on Sunday morning, and then I head off to actually do a survey tomorrow to a lucky facility in New Jersey who already knows I'm coming. So.
And of course, this is a really busy week for all of the news in the industry.
Absolutely. And we're also very excited to welcome our new sponsor, CareDirect, and our guest in our second segment, Nader Sahar from CareDirect. He's the general manager who will be talking about drug security and storage. And we're going to talk a little bit about the CMS regulations regarding drugs. We've become very good friends with Nader and his team over at CareDirect, and we're very excited about having them on board. So we absolutely love their product.
We saw Kenneth at the Ohio State Association meeting, and it was nice to see him.
Yeah,
they're great company.
Absolutely. I should also mention that we are looking for sponsors for the podcast. Hopefully, anybody that is interested will kind of observe how we deal with sponsors here. With over 11,000 downloads, the ASC Podcast with John Gailey has been serving the needs of the ASC industry with current news and information for almost 2 years now. So for more information, if you're interested, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. And I also want to point out that this is ridiculous. We have this high-tech studio here, brand new with all kinds of new equipment here, and all of the new computer equipment is off to the side, and all of our older equipment is in front of us because the new equipment is not working right now, and we're not sure what's going on.
So more expensive, more problems. I don't know what that is.
And it's kind of ridiculous because we have five computers across in front of us. I don't even know which one to use, you know, when I'm pulling up the information here. So this is it's going to be an interesting episode, and hopefully all the recording equipment is at least working right. So
yeah, work in progress. So John, I feel like I say this every single time we record, but you have been really busy again. Talk about what's going on.
I know. It's been an incredible couple of weeks, and I think we've mentioned a number of times that we have a lot of centers that are under construction, and for a company that doesn't spend a lot of time on new facilities, I don't know why I continue to say that. It really is not true anymore. but we did have three pre-opening surveys, but those are the surveys that you do just before a center opens. We've had three of them within the last 14 days. All of them went very well with a bit of a codicil to that. So we have an issue in New York City with organizations that have UPS backup power systems. And one of our centers, which is under construction and nearing completion, has an issue because it has a UPS system. And the New York State Department of Health has indicated to us that they're now requiring single specialty GI centers to replace their UPS systems with gas power generators. Now, for new centers, what we have heard, though we're checking on this, is that we're being told that we might not be able to open until we convert our UPS systems to a gas power generator, which is particularly upsetting since the Department of Health has already approved all of these facilities with the UPS systems that were designed into the facilities. So,
yeah, that's, like you said, the most frustrating part of it, because this is something that's been approved that is going to be very difficult to add. You know, not so much in upstate, but in the city, it's going to be very difficult.
Right. And they are going after existing centers, too, and basically telling them that they're going to have to convert their UPS systems to gas power generators. A good friend of mine, Anton Mitchell, in the city, who is an architect down there, said to me, this is kind of ridiculous because we're replacing 21st century UPS technology with 1960s vintage technology in the form of a generator, and that a UPS, you know, has no delay, you know, when power goes off, where the generator has up to 10 seconds delay.
Yeah, generator is worse environmentally. I mean, that's there's just so many reasons. As long as you're not a place that does the general anesthesia, where you really need a long-term solution, this and will certainly get you through any of those shorter procedures.
And we all agree that, I think, for longer procedures that need to have some power downtime, that a gas power generator is probably best. But, you know, for these GI centers, this is a problem. And it's and particularly a problem for the New York City facilities. And I would imagine any large metropolitan area. I know New York City very well. But, you know, these facilities are often in high-rise facilities or other densely populated areas. And it is actually probably going to be absolutely impossible to put a fuel generator in one of those locations. So if you are listening from New York and I've just scared you, here's the good news is that the New York State Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers and Physicians Endoscopy, which is one of the major players in the GI industry in New York State, they are working with the state to try to resolve this issue. So more information to follow, and we'll see what happens. Of course, if you have any issues in this area, feel free to contact me at Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. Sue, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the news in the industry? We've got quite a bit going on.
ASCA's National Advocacy Day took place on September 23rd and 24th, with 60 ASCA members participating and meeting with Congress members and congressional staff. Besides the general advocacy and information about the ASC industry that they always do, they focused on two important areas of legislation. One was Removing Barriers to Colorectal Cancer Screening Act, which was introduced in March 2019. This act addresses the requirement for Medicaid beneficiaries to cover the cost of their copayments for any screening colonoscopy that is reclassified as therapeutic due to a polyp being removed. This is a huge barrier for a lot of people, as the copay can be into the hundreds of dollars. It seems that some patients are avoiding having the screening altogether once they know about this, and other patients may just be very surprised at the end when they find out that what they thought they were going in for was a free screening, and because something was found that they have this huge bill. When you consider the cost of treating later stage colorectal cancers, it's really a no-brainer. It just makes sense from a patient care perspective and a financial perspective to help people to catch this early. So I'm hoping that they'll make some progress with this.
And it's very confusing for patients when you try to explain to them that you know, their fee might be this or it might be that, depending upon what they find. So I think that this is a great bill, and I'm hoping that something will definitely happen as a result of this.
And the second is the Ambulatory Surgery Center Quality and Access Act of 2019, or H.R. 4350, which is meant to modernize the payment system for ASCs under the Medicare program, add an ASC representative to the Advisory Panel on Hospital Outpatient Payment, and require disclosure of the criteria used to determine if a procedure is approved to be performed in an ASC, since we currently don't always know the reason behind the decision. So it's very helpful if we can find that out. And it'd be great to have an ASC representative included on some of these advisory panels. So again, it's just trying to improve our input and our involvement.
Right. And it's actually kind of shocking that an industry as large as the ASC industry now still doesn't have a voice on MedPAC, which is that panel that they're referring to. So hopefully these two bills will get some traction. And so if you're not able to attend the fly-in, we encourage you to contact your local representative and encourage them to sponsor or to vote for these bills.
So I just wanted to mention that these activities are so important to any industry. And again, we just want to encourage anyone listening to join and support ASCA, as well as your individual state ASC association. And for more information, go to ascassociation.org.
So probably the biggest news that we want to bring out this week is CMS has finalized the changes that were proposed to decrease the regulatory burden on healthcare providers, specifically ambulatory surgery centers in this case. We discussed this proposal in episode 38, which was dated October 1st, 2018. So, Sue, that was about a year ago. And the changes will take effect on November 29th.
Now, this is something we're going to repeat several times throughout this segment, but you still have to follow your state regulations and your accrediting agency requirements. So this may not change a lot for you. We just want you to be aware of it.
Right.
But always refer back to those other things.
And it's kind of safe to say that even though November 29th is the beginning, none of the other organizations that are involved have had a chance to change any of this. So they may not. Right, and they may not. So depending upon what's going on, be very, very careful with this. I'm actually quite concerned about the impact, especially of one of these items here, on the industry and the potential for people, especially ophthalmology providers, to kind of jump at these changes and not realize that they can get themselves into some pretty deep trouble because these are, you know, some of them are condition level items. So probably the most exciting news coming out of this has to do with transfer agreements and probably the best news for the industry. But again, we have to note that, and I know we're going to say this over and over again, that depending upon your state regulations and your accreditation organizations, this might not be applicable. So currently, the ASC standard with regard to hospitalization is that the ASC must have an effective procedure for the immediate transfer to a hospital of patients requiring emergency medical care beyond the capabilities of the ASC. And the hospital has to be a local Medicare participating hospital or a local non-participating hospital that meets the requirements for payment for emergency services. And there's two options here is that the ASC must either have a written transfer agreement with that hospital or all the physicians performing surgery have admitting privileges at that hospital that meet the requirements of this section. The new requirement is that the ASC must periodically provide the local hospital with written notice of its operations and patient population served. So, you know, CMS had proposed to eliminate this section entirely, but rather than deleting, they are requiring them to periodically provide the local hospital with written notice.
And we don't really know exactly what they mean by periodic or how many of your local hospitals that you have to notify. So we're going to look a little bit deeper into this, and we'll keep talking about this on future episodes.
Right, exactly. And again, be very careful because your local, your state might have different requirements. For example, in the state of Ohio, there are very specific requirements requiring new transfer agreements every 2 years. So that unless the, you know, Ohio changes, for example, this will not affect Ohio. Remember, the more stringent regulations are always those that are in effect. So I think the other thing I'm concerned about, Sue, is that I know this is regulatory reduction, but think about this. If you have an existing transfer agreement, there isn't too much else to do. Now, if you go to this system, now you're going to have a regular reporting burden to the local hospitals. I don't know if that's a regulatory unburdening or not.
And I guess we don't know how many of these things are going to combine. So maybe your state says you have to have a transfer agreement. Do you also maybe then have to add something on top of it to meet some of these things? We don't know yet. We're going to talk more about it, but things don't always work out as being reduced burden when they want to.
You know, for example, in this situation, because the language has changed, if you do have a transfer agreement, you might actually have to meet both the transfer agreement regulations of the state, as well as this new regulation that says that you must periodically provide a local hospital with written notice. So in that situation, you actually have more of a burden on you.
I feel like we might call this episode like the panic episode because I feel like we're saying a lot of, you know, you might have to, but, you know, obviously we'll talk more about it and there'll be a lot more specifics.
As things come through, we will be very specific. So now we'll get to the more controversial things. So,
yes, the thing we're most worried about the doctors not following because they involve the requirements for a comprehensive history and physical. So they're removing the requirement for every patient to have a history and physical no more than 30 days prior to surgery. And will require a policy identifying those patients who will require history and physical pre-surgery. Of course, patients will still need a pre-surgical assessment. And again, you're going to get so sick of us saying this, but we're really worried that a lot of doctors will hear this and say, oh, you know, that's what I've been saying all along that I want to do. But again, still required by many states.
And most of the accrediting organizations, too. So this is, of course, very controversial. This came about as a result of the work of the ophthalmology associations who have always been concerned that the requirements for histories and physicals are way too stringent. So that has caused this change here. And, of course, there are going to be some pretty significant requirements that you have with regard to identifying exactly what type of history and physical you're going to need. So if you actually are allowed to do this, this will have an impact with regard to the 30-day requirement, which is quite a burdensome requirement in many organizations. We find a lot of centers that, sometimes miss that 30 days by a day or two, and then they end up finding themselves having to do a full history and physical. So stay tuned. Be very careful about this. Do not immediately on November 29th go out and ditch all of your H&Ps because you might find yourself unpleasantly surprised to have a condition level citation at your next survey. And it's important to note that CMS has not eliminated the requirement for a pre-surgical history and physical or assessment. We still need to figure out if that patient is really a good candidate for surgery.
Mm-hmm. And in emergency preparedness, the change to the requirement would be to review your emergency preparedness plan and to do training every 2 years instead of doing it annually. And this is a strange one. We talked about it before. So although you must still attempt to coordinate with your local officials, you do not have to document your efforts to contact them.
Right.
So
I have mixed feelings about this because I'm not sure this is a reduction in regulatory requirements. First of all, it's very difficult to keep track of things that change from 1 year to every 2 years. We're very careful in our company and with all of our clients that we just have a regular regime of things that we do every year. I think I would still continue to do everything every year, probably the review of the plan every year since we're reviewing our policies and procedures every year anyway.
Yes.
And again, remember to check your state requirements. For example, in New York where we live, I don't think this is going to impact any of us because all of our requirements are much more rigid. So,
and lastly, HHC sent out an email requesting public comment from accredited ASC organizations, ASC associations, surveyors, and really any other interested parties concerning proposed revisions to ambulatory healthcare accreditation standards. The proposal will be available on the HHC website from 8 a.m. Central Time, October 8th through 5 p.m. Central Time on November 5th. The two items being addressed involve pre-surgical site marking and the management of vaccines. So consider going to the HHC website, which is HHC.org, during that time frame to review these proposals and have your opinion counted. We certainly will be, and we will keep you updated as any changes do occur.
And I guess I should also point out here that HHC's accreditation handbook will not be adjusted yet. Or none of the changes that have just been proposed by, the government through CMS's regulatory unburdening regulation there. So keep in mind, when you see the new accreditation handbook, that there's going to be some issues as to how those new regulations are interpreted.
Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be right back with our focus segment on pharmacy security and storage.
So Nader, welcome as a sponsor of our podcast, and you have a wonderful new product out there. Tell us about your product.
It's a medication security and tracking system. So it's a wall-mounted cabinet with a touchscreen interface, and core to it is that it's simple and intuitive to use. And so it tracks everything that happens in the cabinet. Every user has an individual login, whether it's an ID badge or a PIN code. So once someone logs into the system, it tracks what they access, what they take, if they change any settings. But most importantly for surgery centers, it tracks every inventory transaction for scheduled drugs or any drug that the center wants to count.
So, any product that we want to bring into one of our centers has got to solve a problem, if we want to support it. So what is the advantage over a traditional and less expensive, obviously, a double lock cabinet?
Yeah, so with a double lock cabinet, because they're inconvenient to lock and unlock all day and because they have to find who's got the key and go into it, so a lot of times they're left open during the day.
Right.
The other issue is it really doesn't track anything, so staff have to manually write down where the drugs are going.
Yeah.
They're supposed to count the drugs in the morning and in the evening, and it's kind of like a golf scorecard where they add every transaction up, try to get the right number, and then count and verify at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with the whole double locking?
Yeah, so we have two-factor authentication. So if someone logs in with their badge, to get at a controlled substance, they have to enter a secondary PIN code. And that PIN code is unique to the user, so I can't grab John's badge and get drugs under his name.
Well, and I guess that's the point. You can either use the PIN code or it also ties into badge-based security systems.
That's right. And for controlled substance, it's two-factor authentication.
So how do you control what different staff members can take out at what different times and that kind of thing?
Sure. So our cabinet has 7 individually locking compartments. So you can organize and separately lock drugs by compartments. But within that, you can also load multiple drugs into a compartment if that suits your needs. And when you take a drug, you specify which drug is being taken out to which patient. Mm-hmm. And you close the loop by a witness count at the end of the day. So the system will, behind the scenes, keep a running tally of all the drugs, what the current inventory levels are, where the drugs went. It also records waste and returns. And then when you do your end-of-day counts, it knows what should be in there and tells you if that count is correct or not. And the counts require a witness, so a second user has to come and log in to witness the count.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the price point.
Well, the price point is far less than most people expect because mm-hmm. most people are used to the world of automatic dispensing cabinets, yeah. and that's all that's been available to them mm-hmm. To this point. So we are less than 10%, more often than a 5% range of what those hospital-based systems cost, okay. and without expensive recurring fees.
Right. Mm-hmm. I should also point out that this is not a cabinet that takes up too much space. It's mm-hmm. not much larger than a double-lock cabinet. Yeah. And if you need more space, you also have an auxiliary cabinet that you can use for bulk storage, correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we start off with our main cabinet, which we call MedServe, and people are using their daily use vials in there, their daily use drugs in the cabinet. And some of our customers told us they liked our system, but they wanted to store their sealed box of meds under yeah. the same security and have the same traceability. Mm-hmm. So with them, we designed an expansion cabinet that can do that.
So where can our audience get more information about this?
You can visit our website, caredirectllc.com. You can call me directly. My mobile number is 480-359-3706, or you can email us at info@caredirectllc.com.
And we'll put links on our website for this. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I wanted to start this segment by talking a little bit about the CMS conditions for coverage with regard to the administration of drugs, which is the section of the conditions for coverage that we're referring to, which actually have an impact also on storage. This has to do with section 41648A, and the standard is administration of drugs. And that standard states drugs must be prepared and administered according to established policies and acceptable standards of practice. And specifically, it states that drugs and biologicals used within an ASC must be administered to patients in accordance with formal policies the ASC has adopted, and those policies in the ASC's actual practices must conform to acceptable practices for medication administration. And accepted professional practice and acceptable standards of practice mean that drugs and biologicals are handled and provided in the ASC in accordance with applicable state and federal laws, as well as the standards established by organizations with nationally recognized expertise in the clinical use of drugs and biologicals. So this would include organizations such as the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy and the Institute for Safe Medication Practices and the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, etc. A couple things that we have to remember is that a physician or other qualified member of the medical staff acting within their scope of practice must issue an order for all drugs or biologicals administered within the ASC, and the administration of the drugs or biologicals must be by or under the supervision of nursing or other personnel in accordance with applicable law, standards of practice, and the ASC's policies. Avoiding preparation of medications too far in advance of their use. For example, while it might appear efficient to pre-draw the evening before all medications that will be used for the surgery scheduled the following day, this practice may, depending upon the particular drug or biological, promote loss of integrity, stability, or security of that medication. Any pre-filled medication syringes must be initialed by the person who draws it, dated and timed to indicate that they were drawn, and labeled as both content and expiration date of the drug. And by the way, this is, as we well know, Sue, one mm-hmm. of the most common citations we have and one of the most common problems that we have, especially with our friends, the anesthesiologists, who seem to always forget about this. So, again, probably a good time to remind people to label those syringes. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, there must be records of receipt and disposition of drugs listed in the various schedules. And if the ASC uses any scheduled drugs, you know, make sure that policies and procedures should address the following: accountability procedures to ensure control of the distribution, use, and disposition of the scheduled drugs. Records of receipt and disposition of all scheduled drugs must be current and must be accurate. Records to trace the movement of scheduled drugs throughout the ASC, including throughout all the storage locations. And a licensed healthcare professional who has been designated responsible for the ASC's pharmaceutical services is responsible for determining that all drug records are in order and that an account of the scheduled drugs is maintained and reconciled. The record system, delineated in policies and procedures, tracks the movement of all the scheduled drugs from the point of entry into the ASC to the point of departure, either through administration to the patient or destruction or return to the manufacturer. The system provides documentation on scheduled drugs in a readily retrievable manner to facilitate the reconciliation of the receipt and disposition of all the scheduled drugs. All drug records are in order, and an account of all scheduled drugs is maintained, and any discrepancies in count are reconciled promptly. I can't stress that enough, that anytime you have a drug count issue, you need to reconcile it right away. It needs to be funneled through the Quality Improvement Committee as an exception. If you have a pharmacy consultant, you need to, you know, talk to the pharmacy consultant about that situation and see if there's any change in the processes that you have in the organization to rectify that in the future. And the ASC system has to be capable of readily identifying loss or diversion of all controlled substances in such a manner as to minimize the time frame between the actual loss or diversion to the time of detection and determination of the extent of the loss or division. Now, all of these things that I've talked about are from the interpretive guidelines from CMS for this. So, I mean, I think a lot of what we've just been talking about leads us to our focus segment today and our guest, which is Nader Sahar. So Nader talks in this segment about drug storage, which is a very important issue. One thing that we really don't talk about a lot. So I thought that that would be an interesting thing to bring him into it. Mm-hmm. And of course, his organization, Care Direct, is sponsor of our podcast, and he has a great product to talk about also, which was mentioned in the beginning and certainly during the advertisement that we included with this segment. So I would, again, like to emphasize that that product does have a lot of advantages to the industry and solves a lot of the problems that I just talked about with regard to tracking that drug through the process. Regardless of whether you use an electronic alternative such as Care Direct has, or you use the old-fashioned double lock cabinet and paper in order to track it, you need to take this seriously. You need to make sure that two healthcare professionals are involved in logging and tracking any scheduled drugs, and that any issues, as I said, any discrepancies are resolved immediately and reported through the Quality Improvement Committee. You know, Sue, I've run into a situation this last week where I had a hard time convincing somebody in upper management in an ambulatory surgery center the importance of incident reporting and the importance of making sure that anything that is unusual is reported through the Quality Improvement Committee. And whereas all of the staff, the nursing staff, and the people in the direct path understood it, these individuals in the upper management had a hard time really understanding the purpose of incident reporting. And really, like we know, often happens in hospitals, incident reports are considered to be really bad things. And you know, this individual kind of said, well, this place, you know, runs like a top. We never have any problems in any of our areas. And she basically kind of said that if anybody issued an incident report, you know, they're going to be in trouble.
It is.
That's right.
Finding out what type of issues you have and you're correcting them. And if you don't have any, it's not going to look good. It's the opposite of what people think sometimes.
Our award-winning centers have probably the most incidents reported because they really take this process seriously and want to use those incidents to kind of, you know, make sure that they track all of the things that they've identified and can prove to, you know, outside organizations, surveyors, and themselves as to what they've done in order to fix things. My favorite story involves, you know, one of our doctors in, I'm going to say it's in Westchester, and he's just fantastic. And I remember when I first met him, he said, if anybody has an incident, I'm going to fire them. And I said, not a good idea, doctor. And I found out, you know, I looked at his facility. It was impeccable. Everything, the place was spotless. He was an incredible healthcare provider. And it became apparent to me that he is a stickler for details. So I said, you know, what types of things haven't gone right this last week? And I said, well, you know, I had some problems with dust in the corner. The cleaning company just really was not doing a good job of cleaning. I saw dust here. And, you know, I called them right up. I told them that this is not appropriate. If they don't fix it, you know, they're no longer going to be around. And I said, and how did you document that? I said, you know, he said, I didn't. I said, well, that was an incident. Even though, I mean, it was significant to him. He mm-hmm. took it very seriously. He did something about it. He just never documented. And that's what we want to see in quality mm-hmm. improvement.
Sometimes a really good administrators or owners, doctors, whatever, it's so ingrained in them. I see a problem, I'm fixing it. They don't even think about it as being a process, but it is.
And you as a nurse, I know, I mean, nurses just fix things. They just, you know, take care of it. They don't usually make a big deal out of it. And you are sometimes my worst offenders. And it's not because you don't want to document this. It's just mm-hmm. you deal with so many things on a daily basis that you just fix it and you don't worry about who's going to get credit for it, et cetera. But incident reporting and quality improvement is really the process of documenting all those steps that you take in your organization to do that. And back to our issue with pharmacy, this is one of those things I don't usually see a lot of pharmacy incidents documented. And again, I think sometimes they just fix it. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage you to, you know, take this seriously in this area, because it's rare that you actually have a major incident, thankfully. But if you do, of course, that definitely has to be documented. But even minor ones that you can learn from, that you can use as an mm-hmm. example when you're talking to your staff, that you can document in your quality improvement program and in your quality improvement minutes, will really help to show how you're taking care of every little thing.
And think about if you ever do have a really big incident, how much better it's going to be if they can look back and see all these small ones that you've dealt with and see the process, instead of, oh, we had this huge incident, we've never, ever, ever had anything wrong before. That's just not going to look as good. So don't look at it as a bad thing.
Right. And you bring up a very good point, too, is that sometimes we're going to encounter an ongoing problem in some area. And surveyors really want to see that you've been working on it. And if a surveyor comes in and sees that you continue to have this problem, but we see a documentation trail showing that you've been working on it, been trying different solutions, we're actually going to be very pleased that you're working on it. It's not like we're the ones that discovered it. You discovered it. You just mm-hmm. haven't been able to completely solve that problem yet.
Yep.
So on to our guest. Natter spoke to us. I think we were in California when we recorded this segment.
Yes.
And he talked quite a bit about storage in the organization. So let's listen to this interview.
John and I are here talking to Natter Sahar, the general manager of CareDirect. Welcome.
Thank you, Natter. Now, we've talked a little bit about your product. You're a new sponsor of our podcast, and welcome on board. And we thought today we would talk a little bit about security and storage of drugs, which is a big issue in an ambulatory surgery center. You know, we have to deal with both scheduled and non-scheduled drugs, sometimes large quantities, sometimes small quantities. And both of those, depending upon how much you have, presents very different challenges. So you're an expert on security and storage. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that ambulatory surgery centers face with storage of drugs to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when it comes to storing controlled substances and narcotics, really, small facilities and large alike need to make sure they're properly secured and stored and tracked so nothing goes missing and everything's accounted for. Mm-hmm. And the problem that surgery centers face is that there's not really a solution that's built for them.
Right.
This has been focused on in the hospital, and you have several brands of automatic dispensing cabinets that are built for that space and serve that space very well.
And take up a lot of space.
And cost a lot of money.
And cost a lot of money.
And the other thing is they're really complex. Yeah. They're complex to implement. You know, an ASC doesn't necessarily have an IT staff and a staff that can get in and do an integration and programming.
Right.
So it's totally not built for anything that's subacute, I would say.
Right.
But there is a need in that market, in the surgery center market, to secure and track these drugs. So some of these players are trying to fill that need and bring their hospital solution down to the surgery center market. And it's really just not a good fit.
Can you tell us a little bit about what requirements the surgery center faces with regard to controlling the storage of these drugs?
Well, at a minimum, and an absolute minimum, for a controlled substance, they need to make sure it's double locked. They need to restrict access to it. And they need to keep logs of where the drugs are going. Mm-hmm. They need to count the drugs in the morning and in the evening, really at the beginning of the shift and end of the shift. So they count the drugs in the morning. They keep a log of where every drug goes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the majority of surgery centers you'll find are still on paper. And it's a little bit like a golf scorecard, right?
Yeah.
So you tally everything up at the end of the day. You see what should be there. And then you do your count again at the end of the day and make sure everything's reconciled and that nothing's missing.
And you make sure you follow up on any discrepancies that you identify.
That's right.
Yeah. And run it through the QI program. Talking about from the QI side of this is that should be fully disclosed as part of your quality improvement, that there was an issue and that you identified and followed through on what it was. If there's a reporting requirement, depending upon what happened, you need to follow that through with the quality improvement
Absolutely.
Program.
So, you know, one of the things that I've seen in our centers, most of them have double lock cabinets for the controlled substances, but I have one client that has this huge safe that looks more like it should be in a bank.
Yeah.
Let's make it clear that we don't need that, right?
No, that is not a requirement.
Yeah. And jokingly, storing the key right next to the double lock cabinet, what do you think of that idea?
I've seen better ways of going about it. Yeah. And then I've seen double locking cabinets with the two doors, and once you open the first door, the keys
in there. And, well, got to be convenient, right?
Yeah. The issue is really, I mean, people aren't trying to be sneaky. They're just trying to get their job done, and it's difficult. You know, when we were coming up with the concept for our solution, we interviewed a lot of people, and I also remember a nurse told me what we want. And maybe people won't tell you this, but what we want is we want to think of a drug and have it in our hand.
Yeah.
And anything else gets in the way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so finding a nurse that has the key is a problem.
Yeah.
So you'll find a lot of centers will come in, unlock the cabinet during the day, leave it open so that people can get what they need.
Yeah. Right.
They kind of trust people there.
Yeah.
And some of them have even told me when we're going to get audited, then we'll lock it. And, you know, I don't blame them because they're just trying to take care of patients, which is their job. Mm-hmm.
Well, and they don't generally think about the ramifications of that. They don't think about the security. They trust the people that they're with.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we know in our business is that we really can't always trust everybody.
Yeah.
You know, even our most beloved anesthesiologist or nurse, they can be somebody that is a drug diverter or something like that. And that's a big topic right now.
It is a big topic. And I think people are starting to realize that a lot of people still have this concept that they could tell someone that would abuse drugs just by looking at them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not the case. There's people that are working high that you might not even know about.
Yeah.
Good people get caught up in this. It's not as people imagine it would be. There's good people that have been great nurses for 20 years and all of a sudden get a pain pill addiction and get caught up in it.
Yeah. Well, to that end, the people that we've run into over the years, they've been the last person we would have suspected. Absolutely the last person. Yeah. So that's a great takeaway here is that we just have to have a system that secures against any possibility.
Yeah.
What is the difference between storage for a scheduled drug and a non-scheduled drug?
Really, the biggest requirement is that a controlled substance needs to be double locked.
Okay.
That's the primary difference. The other thing is that they're logged every time they're taken.
Right. And access to these drugs should only be by a licensed individual.
Yes.
Right. Which means a nurse or a doctor.
That's correct.
An MA is not somebody that should have access to these drugs.
No.
Unless it's under the direct supervision of a licensed person.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So let's just talk a little bit about the options. We kind of mentioned this before, the options for storing, and you know, really talk about scheduled drugs right now.
Sure.
We talked about the standard double lock cabinets, which are relatively inexpensive, but not totally inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And how do they need to be secured? There are some, you know, rules about how they need to be secured. You know, like just putting it inside a cabinet, for example, is not enough to do that. So what are the rules around securing those devices?
Yeah, you need to have a reasonably built cabinet that is, let's say, not transportable, so it can't just be picked up and moved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That being said, to accommodate workflow, there's always workarounds that you see. The biggest example is probably anesthesia. A lot of times, drugs will be kitted for anesthesia in a tackle box, a locked tackle box. I think the concept there is that it's only supposed to be for in use, but in general, the drug should be in a cabinet that's secured to the wall or something that cannot easily be removed from the facility.
Right. Yeah. Which does bring up an interesting topic. As a surveyor, one of the challenges that I always have is one of the things I do anytime I go into the operating room is I check to see if the anesthesia cart is locked or unlocked. And I'll tell you, it's at least 50% of the time it's unlocked.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm alone in the room. You know, I try not, especially if I'm a surveyor, I try not to be alone in the room. You know, but I look around and suddenly, you know, first of all, why do they leave a surveyor alone in a room? It's like kid in a candy store, you know, you shouldn't do that. But, you know, those things have to be locked at all points. Otherwise, all that effort that you did to store things in the first place are down the tube when it got to the anesthesia cart.
One of our main themes that we work on in this company is focusing on workflow and real life scenarios because we know no matter how good your system is, if it's cumbersome, if it's inefficient, if it gets in people's way, eventually they're going to start working around it.
Right.
You know, to your point about anesthesia carts, I was in a facility that had an anesthesia cart with automatic lock and drawer. So all you had to do is close the drawer,
yeah,
and it would lock. But the workaround there was they just huffed the drawers open. Yeah. And it was a nurse's responsibility to walk around and make sure they were all closed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a good point. You know, you can come up with all these great solutions, but if it doesn't fit into their workflow, then not going to do it.
30 years ago, I remember we had a drug diversion in a center back, you know, when I was running a center, a cleaning person had discovered where they kept the keys for the double lock cabinet. And they were in the nurse manager's desk. And I still remember going through that, you know, the DEA comes in, the guy's carrying a gun, you know. We just admitted what it was. And he said, well, you probably shouldn't do that anymore, right? He said, yes. You know, there was no fines or anything like that. Sure. And I still remember it was morphine that was taken. And they asked the price of it, which I think was 20 cents. And then the street value, which he actually, the DEA agent supplied that number for us.
Sure.
And that was the whole issue there. And, it, you know, it wasn't a huge deal, but it was an eye opener because the nurse manager thought that, you know, I put it in there, nobody would think. To look in there.
Yeah.
But to that end, your best systems can be overridden by, you know, like you were talking about with, you know, leaving the drawers open.
Exactly.
So again, I don't mean to hound on this whole safe issue. Is first of all, I've seen this, especially in older centers, or I've even seen it in a new center where they just insist on a safe. It is clear that there's no higher level of security. If anything, probably a lower level of security because of there's sure to be some workarounds if somebody has something that inconvenient.
Yeah. You know, we always say that if someone is going to break into your facility overnight, let's say, with whatever tools they want, get into your med room. With tools, they're going to get at it. These solutions really aren't designed to stop someone from coming in with tools and breaking into the safe. Really, the issue that needs to be addressed is things going missing when they shouldn't.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the focus should be to stop intruders, but to stop things from going missing because your systems are so cumbersome, they're not being used correctly.
Right. Yeah. Right. And being able to maintain an accurate count at all times and usage, be able to track that drug from, you know, the moment it comes in-house to is either dispensed or wasted or disposed of.
So you can figure out what happened if something does come up missing. Or
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about automatic dispensing systems. Now, up until probably 8 years ago, I'd never seen any in a surgery center.
Yeah.
And then I remember this. We had this client in Louisiana. Not only did he have one of these systems, he had two of them. And, you know, it was a very small center who did very few cases, less than 100 cases a month. Wow. But he's one of those docs, first of all, had probably more money than he needed. and he just had to have the newest toys.
Sure.
And he really got into a lot of trouble with that system because it required an awful lot of work. And you were telling me just before we recorded here that you ran into a situation where somebody had one of these units and ended up... Yeah. Well, tell me the story.
Yeah, I ran into someone today that told me they got an automatic dispensing cabinet for their facility, for their surgery center, because they wanted to track things. Even though they knew it was going to be a big system and expensive, they thought it was worthwhile.
Mainly from an operational standpoint, to be able to improve their flow.
Yeah, makes sense. And they have that tracking and insight. And then they got it installed, deployed. It's a whole process to get this thing set up. Right. And after they did, the state of California said, well, with this system, you need to have a pharmacist on staff. And they did not know that going in.
And at least until they get the system out of there, they're going to have to do that or shut down. Yeah,
that's
in the meantime.
Right. That's right. So he said they're killing their margin right now.
Yeah.
And,
you know, I talked to another center. It was actually an 8-OR center. And to their credit, they put a dispensing cabinet in every OR, which is a remarkable workflow. They said that it's working well for them from a workflow and traceability perspective, but it takes the administrator 10 hours a week to stock and maintain it.
Yeah. Well, and this client in Louisiana that I work with, one of the things that we had to do as part of the quality improvement program is oversee and monitor the systems for maintaining that, which inevitably, it wasn't a very big place, didn't have many people. So the doctor and the nurse both had to spend that time in order to maintain the security for it.
Yeah.
And what made it even worse is that there was a lot of turnover in the nursing staff because, you know, they weren't doing a lot of cases. So that just made things. So any system you develop has got to be something that's easily monitored, especially if it's automatic. You're going to have to be able to easily control, change the, you know, security levels, add people, take people off.
Yeah.
And make sure you control that. Again, otherwise, you've just lost your security.
Yeah. And we believe it needs to be intuitive. Like you said, there's turnover in these centers. And then administrators generally don't turn over that often, but they are overwhelmed with a million tasks and changing regulations. So
that's right.
They don't want to be looking through a manual to figure things out. You know, and if you use an app on your phone, you generally don't need any instruction. You can understand how to use it. And that's, that's kind of our mentality as well.
So I think it's fair to say, based upon what we just talked about, the standard ADC unit really isn't a good solution for the average surgery center that we have out there.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. They're too large for the space available. They're too expensive, frankly.
Right.
The equipment cost is too expensive. The ongoing service fees is too much. And they're too complex. They're not easy to deploy or to maintain.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that leads us to really the subject of your sponsorship of the podcast and other alternatives out there, because there really hasn't been a solution out there as of yet. So now entering the market is this new product that you have. So talk a little bit about it, just, you know, in generic sense. And
yeah, so our product is really designed for this marketplace. It's wall-mounted, 4 inches deep, so it can go in a hallway, deal with space constraints that some of these surgery centers are facing. It's simple and intuitive.
Right.
Installation to initial setup is about an hour. Very often we will train a facility on the use of the cabinet, and then we don't hear from them again. We have to check in on them, and they say, everything's fine. You know, we know how to use it. So, it's just really simple and intuitive. It connects to the cloud, generates reports to the cloud, so you have that information there.
Right. So it obviates the need for a paper trail like you've had in the past.
Yeah, so you right on the cabinet, it has a touchscreen interface that is simple and intuitive, so you can log which drugs you're taking for which patient, and it replaces your paper narcotic logs.
Right.
Sends that information to the cloud, so an administrator from any location can see what's going on in a facility or across multiple facilities. You can see inventory levels, drug usage. Mm-hmm. And what we think is important is we've left our system flexible. Mm-hmm. So a facility can determine which drugs they want to double lock. As an example, some centers double lock propofol, others do not. And also which drugs you want to count. So if you have Benadryl and you don't care about counting it, it's just very simple, quick access. It takes probably 5 seconds to get a Benadryl out of the cabinet if you have it set up that way. If you do want to count Benadryl, then that's your option, and you can count it and see where it's going.
So you're talking about how the product can store both scheduled and non-scheduled drugs in different levels, but can't it also deal with non-drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. You can track anything you want.
Probably not Band-Aids.
But. No,
well, you could, but you probably don't want to.
So what we're seeing people use it for, and we didn't think about it in the initial design, is that they want to track anything of high value,
right?
Be it supplies or drugs. We work with a center that is using our cabinet to track HIV medication.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because it's quite expensive. The reimbursement associated with it is quite a lot of money.
Right.
And, you know, they weren't having drugs go missing because they're being abused, but, you know, maybe someone's not accounting for administration to a patient and not documenting it correctly.
Or you might not be able to bill it because you didn't track properly the usage of it. That's a good point.
Exactly. So they're missing supplies, they're missing billings. And, like I said, our cabinet's flexible to give you the ability to track anything you want.
Right. Well, at Natter, on behalf of the industry, first of all, it's nice to see a product that's been designed specifically for the ASC industry. So thank you for that. And certainly your product fills a different niche, you know, at a price point that is affordable for the average surgery center. And we welcome you as a sponsor here. And we really only allow that for products that we, you know, personally believe in. And both Sue and I have seen this product in action. We just actually saw in person, we're recording this actually from California, where we actually waited able to see it in person rather than when we first were introduced to it by video chat. But again, thank you so much. And thanks for being on our podcast.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Natter. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with the upcoming events in the industry. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
So with every episode, we inform you of upcoming events. If you would like to have your event included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
And remember that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC Association. John is available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting.
The South Carolina ASC Association fourth quarter membership meeting in Columbia, South Carolina. It's on October 8th, so by the time you listen to this, it's probably already over with, but it's October 8th in Columbia.
The Indiana Federation of ASC's Fall Conference and Trade Show is October 18th, 2019 at 502 East Event Center in Carmel, Indiana.
The Minnesota ASC Association's 2019 annual conference is October 24th and 25th in Minnetonka, Minnesota.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis in New York.
And the New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference is in Tarrytown, New York on November 6th and 7th, 2019. We're going to be there in spades. We just registered, I think it was almost everybody in the company,
I think so.
And we got our hotel room, and but I think the time for the discount is over at this point, but definitely sign up for it. I'll be doing a couple sessions there, and Lori Rodericks is going to be doing some sessions on infection prevention, as well as a couple other people. So it's going to be an exciting conference.
It's going to be a good one.
And if you're even if you're just on the border of New York State, there's a lot of good content. Even if you're not from New York State, but definitely New York State providers, please sign up for this. It's an extremely important conference, and we do hold two conferences a year. This is the one in New York City, and I believe the one in the spring is actually also going to be in New York City. We're kind of resetting things so that the spring conference will be in the city and the fall conference will be upstate.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association's 12th annual seminar on infection prevention and surveillance in the ASC is November 7th and 8th in Costa Mesa, California.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 annual education conference and trade show is November 14th and 15th at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
ASCA 2020 winter seminars are in New Orleans, Louisiana, January 16th through 18th.
And the AORN Global Surgical Conference is in Anaheim, California, March 28th through April 1st, and it includes a day and a half ASC summit for administrators, directors, business and clinical managers, and staff, focusing on financial management, team communication, multimodal pain management, and much more. For more information, go to the ARN.org site. And our dear friend Ann Geyer is a principal speaker there, so please please definitely support this organization. And Sue, I know we're considering sending you to that, so I don't know what if we've made a decision there. We'll probably reach out to them and see if they're even in the least bit interested in having the ASC podcast there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like a lot of really good information, very ASC specific. And they do have other summit type things there, so just lots of...
And again,
information for anyone.
As we try to point out to everybody, please consider joining the ARN organization. Mm-hmm. It provides a lot of good information
Resources.
For people in the ASC industry.
And the Iowa Association of ASC's 12th Annual Education Conference is April 17th and 18th, 2020 in Johnston, Iowa.
The ASCA 2020 conference is in Orlando, Florida, May 13th through the 16th. It's getting time, I think, to sign up for it. So definitely consider going to the ASC Association website and getting in on this, the largest conference in the country for ambulatory surgery centers.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again and spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsor, CareDirect LLC, which manufactures medication security cabinets that improve efficiency and safety in healthcare facilities by electronically managing medications near patient care areas. For more information about their great products, visit CareDirectLLC.com. That's CareDirectLLC.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring with ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.